Hi, my name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ben.
Thanks for having me. I'm pretty nervous, but I was thinking about how it's nice to be nervous about this sort of thing rather than, like, I don't remember what happened yesterday. Because I do remember what happened yesterday, and it was a good day. So, like I said, my name's Ben. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 7th, 2008. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. My home group is the Living Sober Group in Charlottesville. We have 5 meetings a week. That's all the preamble I need to give to try to get myself less nervous. I think the general gist of it is that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. So, what we used to be like. I started drinking at about 15. The first time I drank, I blacked out. I can remember being really excited about the prospect of drinking, even though I didn't really know what it would entail. It still excited me. I was at a party with my older brother, who's 9 years older than I am, and his friends, and it was exciting to be around people who I thought were adults and acting like adults. We're probably also drinking to blackout, and I just got there faster than they did, and I had no thought of the consequences. The next day I was in Connecticut, and I was supposed to fly home to Chicago, and was barely able to get on the plane and lied to my mother and said that I was just sick. Had missed, you know, we were supposed to have our last breakfast together. I was going back to be with my father and missed that, didn't give a second thought to it, never thought about that the night before. So my drinking was immediately sort of characterized by selfishness, self-centeredness, lying, disregard for consequences. Didn't even care about it. And it did occur to me, you know, the next day, That probably wasn't a lot of fun, or at least I don't feel good right now. I don't think I'm going to drink for a little while. And, you know, circumstances allowed me to not drink for a little while. So I didn't, for probably about another 3-4 months, I was 15, 16 in high school. There wasn't a lot of booze around. It was actually much easier to get other things. Alcohol was hard to come by. And I spent the next few years addicted to, or at least engaged with, outside issues. And the alcohol didn't really rear its head. That doesn't mean that I didn't end up in rehab. I didn't end up in the behavior disorder program of my high school. I went from being an honors student to barely graduating, you know, and all those consequences came, and I became convinced that I just had a problem with authority. That was my big problem, which was authority's problem, not mine. And what I really needed was just to be left alone, and that would be okay. You know, then everybody could go about their business, I could go about mine, and everything would work out. You know, and that's how I thought I was going to live my life. And I was just a rebel, which, you know, you guys have taught me meant that I was just a spoiled brat, but I had to get here to learn that. So, you know, I don't want to spend much more time on the earlier sort of period, you know, just for identification purpose. I mean, my parents were divorced when I was at a young age, but I don't really blame them for anything. They did the best they could. And you guys have taught me that. It doesn't matter. It's not their problem. It's my problem. You know, especially I was thinking about it today on Mother's Day, and just to be able to have good recollections and good associations with my parents when I think about them is a gift of the program, instead of a resentment, you know, and blaming them for things that really had nothing to do with them, but had a lot to do with me. And even the things that did have to do with them, people just do the best they can. And that's what you guys have taught me. My drinking really took off when I went to college, when I was 20. I didn't really want to go to college. I went to I enrolled and dropped out of a community college before ever attending a class, which should have sort of set the pattern for how things were going to be, and then went to the only school that would take me, which was an open enrollment art school in downtown Chicago. Went for a semester and dropped out. I went for a year and dropped out. By the second semester, I knew I wasn't going to go back. I was living with my dad, and he tolerated it because his notion was, as long as you go to school or work, you can stay here. And I went to school and worked. And so I thought that I was doing what I was supposed to do. You know, I had a job. I usually went. You know, I was not a very good employee, but I thought I was doing okay, and it was, you know, I was young, it was just a transition period anyways, whatever. I didn't care too much about whether I was fulfilling the responsibilities that I had signed on to when I took a job. And I went to school, and I was, you know, I usually went, but, so I really thought that everything was okay. And, you know, the alcoholism was there before I started to pour alcohol on it. You know, the disease was there in a variety of forms that when I look back on it, I can see, and it just needed the booze to take it to a next level. And I went to college, and I went away to college, and the first day at school, I walked into my dorm room, and I opened the fridge, and there was beer in the fridge. And I specifically remember thinking, and I think I said it out loud, oh, this is going to be good. It didn't matter that it was my roommate's beer, which I then stole, without, like, telling him. He's like, where'd the beer go? I'm like, what beer? You know, like, so, again, it was immediately about lying and selfishness and stealing. And it was never, the drinking was never associated with, you know, being of service to others. And any of the stuff that you guys have taught me is really what I'm supposed to be doing with my time and with my life. You know, and college was pretty much an exercise in controlled drinking. I didn't black out much, and I'm not sure I really had much between that first time I drank and a few years sort of after things started really hitting the fan. But, you know, in college, I was able to hold it together enough for classes. I was able to hold it together enough to have relationships. At some point, it did occur to me that I was drinking every day, but I really thought that's what adults do. I was like 22, so I was like, I can buy it on my own, I'm not breaking any rules. I didn't have a car, so I didn't have to worry about drinking and driving, so I thought I was being responsible. But I was drinking every day, and it came to the point that I had to drink to fall asleep. You know, I was in a relationship with this woman, and she, at one point, you know, sort of subtly, backhandedly called me on it, you know, like, are you going to make yourself another drink, you know, before we go to sleep? And I remember getting really mad, you know, that someone would dare sort of challenge my right to drink. And I can identify with somebody in a meeting this morning, who I think is sitting here right now, said, you know, if you got between me and the drink, I was going to run you over, you know, and there was no sort of thought about it. And that was my experience, that even the people closest to me, and especially people the closest to me, were the ones who were really going to suffer the brunt of the drinking. And so, you know, things went on pretty functionally. I did everything I was supposed to do to graduate, and I pretty much did everything I was supposed to do to graduate and still had a semester left of college where it didn't really matter what happened in the classes, and then I started to drink to blackout all the time. Not every day, but on a much more regular basis. And my behavior started to become much more erratic and dangerous to the people around me. And I started to have people that I've now had to make amends to. You know, that's when I started to behave in that sort of way. With no regard for other people's feelings, especially women. No regard for trying to be in no regard for anything except what I could get out of a situation. You know, that's why when my sponsor said to me, why don't you think about what you can bring to a situation instead of what you can get out of it? It was a completely foreign idea. This is the complete opposite of how I had been living my life, which is, what can I get out of this situation and the people in it? And then cut my ties and run before they sort of notice that I'm just trying to screw them over. You know, I can remember a few things that stuck out to me from late in college that I think are relevant to my story. And one was a friend of mine said to me, he said, you know, you always surprise me. He basically said, you always surprise me in that you seem to look like you have it so well put together. And then we go out drinking. And, like, everything goes crazy, basically. You know, that you look so good on the outside during the day. I never would have thought. He basically said, you were one of us. I'm waiting for him to come in and be one of us. I haven't seen him yet. But, you know, that was his basic idea. And that notion of living a double life, and the book talks about it, and for me it was more than a double. It was, whoever you are, I'll just put on whatever face I think I want you to see, and I'll have an infinite amount of lives that I live right now, none of which I know the difference between, and I can't tell what's real and what's not real and who I really am. And yet I always thought, if people can just see me for who I really am, they'll be nice to me, and they'll stop, like, giving me a hard time about all this crap that I do to them. You know, if they can just judge me based on my intentions rather than my actions. That's really what I thought, you know, should happen. And I had this fantasy of, I'll just have to move, and then no one will know what I used to be like, and they can meet me for who I really am, which I will construct, you know, this self that is nice and generous and they want to be friends with, basically, so they'll give me stuff. But that was my thought, and that's sort of what happened. I moved to Charlottesville. I came to Charlottesville to go to graduate school. I cut ties with people in Iowa, where I went to college, to the point that the day I was leaving to drive to Charlottesville, I was supposed to pick something up from an ex-girlfriend, and she wasn't there, so I couldn't get into her house to get it, and I called her on her, I called the message and said, I'm leaving, I'll see you never. And that was totally my attitude, and I've seen her since, and it's fine. But that was really my attitude. I was like, I'm never going to see this person again. We had like a 2-year serious relationship and talked about things like marriage. She's dead to me. You know, that was one of my favorite phrases, like, they're dead to me. Which is the insanity, you know, and really doesn't hurt anyone but me. And that's all I was doing. I mean, it does hurt others as well. But really, you know, I just cut myself off from everyone, except for what they could give me. So I moved to Charlottesville. I think within a week, I had gotten a haircut and shaved my beard so that people wouldn't recognize me because of what I had done in a blackout, or what I didn't remember I had done in a blackout, but I was really worried. One, it's not like anybody really paid attention, but I thought I was that important. And two, I just couldn't remember what had happened. So there went the, like, I'll just be this new wonderful person. Instead, it was the first night I go out, I don't remember going to that next bar. You know, I don't remember yelling at the people on the street. The person next to me remembers that and told me about it the next day. And that sense of shame and self-pity and terror, you know, and the four horsemen it talks about in the book that I can never remember, and I don't want to misquote, but those ones, you know, were completely with me about what have I done the night before, and how long do I have to hide in my house until it'll go away? You know, not just that people will forget about it, but that I'll be able to feel like I can leave my house again. That was with me within the first week of moving. It took another 5 years to get sober. But that was, you know, right away. And that was my pattern in Charlottesville. I was a blackout drinker then, and there weren't a lot of non-blackout drinking times, or at least gray out. You know, like glimpses, if someone reminded me of something, I go, oh yeah, I vaguely remember that, which was much worse than not remembering at all. I used to really try to comfort myself with the sense that just because I don't remember what was happening doesn't mean I was actually unconscious. Like, I probably seemed like I had it together, which was not true. I seemed like a, you know, raving lunatic. But I would tell myself, like, I probably seemed like I had it together, so I don't have to be worried when I see this person on the street. And just that sense of not knowing what happened and having to piece it together from other people, if they were willing to talk to me. And sometimes it wasn't even the next day. Sometimes it was an hour later. You know, I would come in and out of consciousness, and I had one instant where someone called me and they really wanted to fight me, and like, I'm pretty small, I don't fight, like, it's not in my best interest to do that, so I didn't want to do that. That seemed like a very bad idea. I was really drunk, it still seemed like a bad idea, and I had no idea why. I could not remember what had happened, and it turned out that an hour earlier I had like made some really inappropriate comments to this woman that he was sort of with. Way out of bounds, and he was upset about it. I had no recollection of that. I still don't really have any recollection of that. But an hour later, I didn't remember that it happened. I was completely confused about what was going on. In Charlottesville, I got a car, so I drank and drove all the time. By the grace of God, I didn't get arrested. I don't know if it was the grace of God, but whatever, I didn't get arrested, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I also didn't hit anybody, which is just grace of God, because I would have, and I wouldn't have remembered it. I had plenty of people in the car with me, you know, and I did not care. I thought it was funny to a certain degree, and that's another part of the insanity of the disease, that I just, you know, putting other people's lives in danger, for amusement didn't seem out of the ordinary. Like, I didn't see anything wrong with it. I didn't wake up and be upset about that. I would be upset about other things, but that actually wouldn't bother me. So things started to get progressively worse. Nothing all that, I mean, there weren't really exterior circumstances that changed that made things much, much worse. My mom died right when I started graduate school, but that didn't really have much of an effect one way or the other. The first time she called me to tell me she was sick, she died of cancer, to tell me she was sick, I was drinking when she called, and I drank after she told me. When they called me to tell me that the cancer had come back, I was drinking when they called me, and I drank, you know, continued drinking. You know, it wasn't like, oh, now I have a... I thought in my head, oh, now I have a reason. But the disease was already there, and I was already drinking. You know, nothing made me an alcoholic, or no outside circumstances drove me to drink. I would look for reasons and excuses to tell other people about, or to think about in my own head to excuse my actions to myself. But, you know, I don't think I have triggers. I think my trigger is waking up. You know, the sun rises. I want to drink. You know, it's rainy. I want to drink. It's sunny. I want to drink. You know, it's not that people don't have triggers. It just wasn't my experience. I could think I had triggers. And there are situations that still today are situations that I don't really go around, or just because of habit and remembrance, or television shows that I only watched while drinking that I just choose not to drink, not to watch now. I also choose not to drink, but I don't choose not to drink. But I also don't watch now because, one, they're not that interesting, and two, like, it just has this habit sort of energy that comes up with it. But I don't think of that as a trigger. You know, it's, I was already drinking when I turned on the TV. It wasn't like I'll turn on the TV and then drink. So things were the same. I got progressively worse. The disease got progressively worse. I had arranged my career so that, I was, I was teaching maybe, you know, two nights a week, and that's the only time I had to be somewhere, and I could pull that off, and it was nighttime, so I could not drink before I went and taught. I had learned not to teach in the morning because that was harder for me, not to still be drunk when I woke up and went to class. And when someone asked me about, he said, "You don't look so good. You know, what are you doing? Why are you going home at 9 o'clock in the morning?" It's like, because I've already taught and I'm going back to sleep because I'm still drunk. So I had constructed my job in a way that it wouldn't interfere with my drinking. And I had started to think about, well, maybe I need to move to be closer to the bars, because then I won't drink and drive. That will be my solution. I will move, you know, so that, because I'm too lazy to walk 10 minutes, but if I only have to walk 5, maybe I won't drive. And that will be the solution to the drinking and driving, which I'm worried about. And, you know, I don't know what happened. You talk about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Nothing happened. Like, there was no, I wasn't arrested, I wasn't intervened upon, nothing happened. I had a year of hell, where I decided that, you know, I went home for Christmas, I went back to Chicago, and just drank my way through the holiday, and every time I was drinking, I would say to people, "I'm pretty sure I'm an alcoholic." I didn't really know what that meant, but it seemed like the right thing to say at the time. They would say, "Yes, me too." Okay, we'd hug, you know. So that was, but it stuck with me. Especially, you know, I said it to my sister, who is not an alcoholic, who, for some reason, cares about me, and she didn't like that. She was very, she thought that was concerning. But then I left. I came back to Charlottesville. And I guess what happened is the alcohol stopped working. You know, it stopped doing what I wanted it to do. No longer could I drink myself into oblivion. I would just drink and drink and drink and get more and more and more miserable. I started having severe physical problems, sort of digestive, intestinal issues, that I went and saw specialists about and lied about my drinking, and so they said, "Well, it's stress, because there's nothing wrong with you. It's just stress." I said, "Yes, I'm very stressed out. I guess that means I need to drink more, you know, to get over the stress." The reason I had all these intestinal problems was because I was doing nothing but drinking alcohol and coffee and eating some pasta every once in a while. You know, it was not, I was killing myself, literally killing myself, slowly. And I couldn't sleep, so I was on sleeping medicine, I was on antidepressants, I was drinking while I was on all these things, so they didn't work. I started seeing a therapist because I thought, something is very wrong, I just need to go talk to someone. And she would ask me about my drinking, and I would say, "Let's talk about something else." Yeah, she once asked me, you know, like, "What is your relationship with alcohol?" And I said, "Alcohol and I have a vexed relationship." Non-alcoholics don't have relationships with alcohol, is something that that occurred to me later on. That, like, it's not a person, you know, and I think a non-alcoholic would have said, "What do you mean, a relationship with alcohol?" Whereas I had an answer. I had thought about this. You know, what is my relationship with this thing that is this creature, this, you know, higher power to me at the time, that is alcohol? And for a year, I struggled with knowing that something was very wrong, that drinking had something to do with it, and that I should probably stop or at least control my drinking, because I had stopped being able to be functional. I could still go to work, sort of, but the rest of the time, I mean, I was literally sitting in a house robe on my chair watching television all day long, and I would get dressed in order to, like, go buy some booze. And even my friends, who drank a lot, went, "You were drinking a lot," you know, and that really stuck with me, because, you know, I would go over to their house and drink two of their bottles of wine by myself, you know, while they would have a half a bottle of wine, and it And I would say, yeah, it's just, I'm just having a bad day, or, you know, it's, this is, I would have excuses. It's the anniversary of my mom's death, so I'm having a bad day, so I'm going to drink an insane amount of alcohol. Didn't matter that I'd done that the day before and would do it the day after. I just wouldn't tell them about that. I was in a relationship with a woman. We had been in one for about, at that point, I think about a year and a half, and she absolutely caught the worst of my drinking, because I could keep it together if I was out with people. And when we would get home, I would lose it. You know, I was, only by the grace of God, not violent, but I would have gotten there. You know, I wasn't far from it. I was sort of right up to that line. And she had a nickname for me. It was Belligerent Ben. It was like, oh, Belligerent Ben will come out. And at first it was funny, but not really. And then it wasn't at all. And she told me later, after I got sober, that she had started going to Al-Anon at one point, which she had never told me. It didn't stick with her. You know, I was pretty good at lying and making excuses for myself, and I think I fooled her to a certain degree, and we didn't live in the same place. So she lived in Baltimore, I lived in Charlottesville. She didn't see it all the time. It just so happened that whenever I was around her, I drank a lot, but she didn't see that it was whenever I was around, I drank a lot. During that year, what I did was try everything that was listed in the big book. If I had seen it in the big book, I would have thought, I haven't tried that yet, I will, to try to control my drinking. You know, and it talks about it. You know, we only drink during the day, or we only drink at night. You know, we switch what we're drinking. We only drink hard liquor, or we only drink beer. We only drink wine. My big one was, I won't drink during the week. And that would work for a couple weeks. And if I was hitting a deadline or something, it's like, well, I won't drink during the week so I can actually get work done. And I would get really productive. And I would get really drunk on the weekends. And then I would be really productive. And then I would get really drunk on the weekend. And then I would just keep getting really drunk the whole week through. And then 2 weeks later, I would realize that I was drinking during the week. I never even saw it coming. Like, it never, like it says, there's no defense. You know, I never even noticed that I wasn't doing what I had said I was going to do. I tried the have only two drinks and then stop, and that worked zero times. Because I'm an alcoholic, and when I put that first drink in, there's no having one more and stopping voluntarily. You know, I could do it if forced to by circumstance. Thanksgiving dinner with my girlfriend's family, a wedding, you know, where it was really important that I keep it together. I could, and I would be miserable. It was the worst thing in the world to have to control my drinking. I hated it. The only way I could enjoy my drinking, or at least not hate it, was to drink as much as I can, pretty much as fast as I can, with no restrictions and no people bothering me about it. So that girl bothered me about it, and so I broke up with her. And absolutely because of the alcohol. 100%. You know, I knew something was wrong, and I was ready to blame everyone around me. And I fooled myself into thinking, well, it's not fair to her, you know, to be in this relationship when I'm not really invested. You know, what I didn't say was, because what I'm really invested in is the alcohol, you know, and that's I'm much more in love with that than I am with any person. And I made amends to her about that. And, you know, I wouldn't say we're close, but she's doing really well, which is a good thing. And, you know, the program has a solution for that, which I'm grateful for. I left her. I continued to try to control my drinking. The summer came, and I had switched to non-alcoholic beer during the week. Learning when I came in here that non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics. You know, when you drink six of them in a sitting, like, maybe something's wrong. There's no reason to do that. It's just no reason to drink non-alcoholic beer. I convinced myself it was the taste that I really liked. Now, even though I would drink anything someone put in front of me. I joined a wine club because I thought that if the wine was expensive, I wouldn't drink it so fast. which is insane. And, like, as someone was talking about, you know, going into a friend's, a non-alcoholic's friend's house, and they had a wine rack with wine in it, and there was dust on the bottles, and how confusing that was, you know. And, like, I bought a wine rack, and it never had more than a bottle in it, because I would drink them immediately by myself, you know. I got mad at the wine people, because one of them, like, I thought that the bottle was corked, and they were like, well, you need to let it breathe for, like, 30 minutes when you open it. And I was like, oh, I just drank it right away. Like, that's probably... Like, you drank the whole bottle, like, right away within 30 minutes? I was like, never mind. We'll have a different conversation. But these are the things that I did to try to control my drinking. That's the insanity of it. In order to control my drinking, I will get more invested with alcohol. That somehow seemed like it was going to make sense to me. Things got worse, and... Or things stayed the same. I got worse. And nothing happened. There was no big event. I had really geared up for... it was the election season. And every debate was a drinking holiday. And every primary vote was a drinking holiday. And I was a news junkie. And I was really invested... emotionally. I didn't do anything about it, but, you know, emotionally in who was going to win. It's like the Super Bowl. It was like a sporting event. And, you know, it wouldn't have mattered if the candidate doesn't matter what my political beliefs are. Right now, they're pretty much nothing. It wouldn't have mattered if the candidate that I wanted to win won or didn't. I was going to drink a lot on that night, either out of joy or out of sadness. And election night came, and I drank to blackout, and it had been this night that I'd been sort of building up in my head as this huge thing, and I couldn't remember the speeches. I could remember who won, but I had to go back the next morning and watch the coverage again, and, like, go on YouTube and watch the acceptance speech and watch the concession speech. And this had been this huge event in my life, and that same night I had... drunkenly driven an ex-girlfriend home, and during the ride, apparently, you know, threatened the life of her boyfriend, and which, again, like, I'm very small, it wasn't going to happen, and, you know, tried to get her to come home with me, and all this, you know, completely out of bounds, inappropriate stuff, not really remembered much of that, woke up the next morning only knowing that I needed to apologize. Like, I would have these instances where I would just wake up, basically you wake up and say you're sorry. I have no idea what I'm apologizing for, but I know that I did something wrong. And it was supposed to be this great day. And, you know, it was just a disaster, just like every other day. And for some reason, that was it. That was enough. That was a Tuesday. The next day, I basically hid in my house. And the day after that, I went to go, it was my normal appointment, to go see my therapist. And I said, I think I have a problem with alcohol. And she said, I think you should go to AA. And I said, absolutely not. I am not going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, why not? And I said, AA is just a bunch of old people complaining about their problems. That is not what I need. I need something that can teach me how to live without drinking. That's what I need, and that's not AA. She looked at me, and she was like, what? Have you ever been to an AA meeting? I said, yes, I've been to one when I was 16. She's like, well, one, you're not 16 anymore, and two, like, you don't know what you're talking about. So how about, you know, you go talk to some people at a rehab center. So I went, I said, okay, I can do that. I'm not going to go to AA, but I'll go, you know, what I need is to get checked into a place. Yeah. I'll go to an outpatient rehab center. So I went and talked to someone at an outpatient rehab center who was an alcoholic. That was on a Friday. Thursday, when I talked to my therapist, after I talked to her, I went out and got drunk. Because I was so nervous about the next day. And I woke up the next day, and I wasn't even sure that I was going to go talk to this woman because I was so embarrassed that I had drank the night before. And when I did, for whatever reason, I walked in, and she said, when's the last time you had a drink? And I just sort of looked at the floor, and she said, was it yesterday? I said, yeah. She said, of course you did. She said, I'm an alcoholic. I understand how alcoholics think. You know, if everything that you've been telling me is true, you may very well be an alcoholic, and it makes perfect sense that you would drink yesterday. It's nothing to be ashamed of, but it's something that you need to do something about. And she said, you can't you can't actually come here to this rehab center because it was at night. It was an outpatient center at night, and I taught at night. She said, but if everything you've been telling me is true, you're not going to make it until, like, the Christmas break when you can come here. You need to go to meetings. You know, and she pulled out a list of meetings, and she circled meetings for me. And she said, here are big meetings, no one will bother you. Like, because that's what I wanted. I said, I don't want anyone to bother me. She was not telling the truth. But turns out even at big meetings, people bother you, which is a very good thing. And the first meeting I went to was the 5:30 speaker meeting in Charlottesville on Friday night, which is now my home group. And someone got up and told his story, and he told my story. Up until the point where he got sober. And what he told after that was what really got me. You know, I identified with everything he said about the drinking. I didn't identify with anything he said about sobriety, but man, I wanted it. And I tried to give myself more time to be sober, but didn't work. Because I really do think that that's the most important, you know, part of the story is it's important to talk about what it was like and what happened, but what's really cool is what it's like now. And that first meeting got me enough to go to another meeting. You know, I bolted out the door at the end of that first meeting, got in my car and drove home. Sat there and watched television and felt uncomfortable. I went to a meeting the next day. I went to a meeting the day after that. I went to a meeting every day until I can't remember. And within maybe 3 weeks, I got a sponsor. Because I kept hearing people talking about getting a sponsor. And I didn't really know what that meant, but I liked... At the beginning, I liked not drinking. And then about 2 weeks in, I really didn't like not drinking. You know, that, whatever you want to call it, pink cloud went away, and I was absolutely miserable, but I did not want to go back to the way it was. And I remember this guy's story, and the story he had told had not been, you know, I stopped drinking and then everything was terrible. It was also, I stopped drinking and everything was wonderful. It was, I stopped drinking and I was able to live life in a sort of sane and responsible manner most of the time with a lot of help. And that seemed like, and continues to seem like, a really good deal to me. And so when things got hard, I got a sponsor. And I don't know why that was. I think it's just because I went to enough meetings where people were brave enough and bold enough to say, you need to get a sponsor. You know, not to me directly, but in general. People would talk about the steps. You know, it turned out it was not just a bunch of people complaining about their problems. It didn't mean there weren't meetings where people complained about their problems. That's fine. But there were also always people who brought it back to the program, who talked about the solution, who talked about what recovery means, especially about the steps and working the steps with a sponsor. And so I was desperate enough and beaten down enough to ask someone to be my sponsor, who happens to be here tonight, which is great. And we got working on the steps immediately. I mean, I went out of town for like a week or 2 weeks right away, and I can remember thinking, and I was leaving the country, and I can remember thinking, I'm worried that he's going to tell me I can't leave the country, that like I'm not going to be able to go visit my new girlfriend who lives out of the country. And if he tells me that, I'm going to have to do that, and that's going to suck. And I don't know where it occurred to me that I have that willingness to actually do that if my sponsor had said, you can't go. Sorry. You're not able to do this. He didn't say that. I went. I stayed sober. I went to meetings. I went to meetings in a foreign language because he sort of tricked me into it. And it was great. The only way he tricked me into it is that I was in Germany, and he sent out this gratitude list, which he never sent to me. And he sent it to me this one time, and it said, I'm so grateful that I have a sponsee who's so into meetings, he's going to go to a German meeting. I was trying to excuse my way out of actually going to this German meeting, but once he put it in print to other people, I was like, oh, God, now I have to go. So he tricked me into it. I don't know if he knows that he did that or not, but that's what happened. I came back, we started on the steps right away. You know, and we went through them quickly without rushing, is how I like to think of it. You know, thoroughly, but we didn't take big breaks. He also didn't force them down my throat. His attitude was very much, you'll do it when it hurts enough. And I did. And he was available for when it hurt enough. I was ready to go, and he was there too. You know, it would have made a difference if my sponsor had said, that's nice, I'm glad it hurts enough for you, I'm busy. And he was busy, but he still made time to do the work of recovery. He also did things like take me to a NASCAR race, which I had never intended to do in my life, and had a blast at with other guys in recovery. Take me to a lake house. I can't really swim. And I was like, and I'm scared of everything, and was out on a jet ski, like, tooling around, having a lot of fun with other guys in recovery to show me that you can actually have fun in recovery. And my sponsor brought me to these things. You know, early on, when, you know, I didn't really know him and I didn't really know these other people, but it wasn't really presented as an option. I mean, it was in a way, but it was just, you want to go do this? I have a ticket. Let's go. Okay, yeah, like, sure, because you also taught me don't say no. In AA, you know, when someone asks you to do something, don't say no. When you guys ask me to come here and speak, don't say no. You know, that's, or I guess you should say yes. You don't just not say no, but, you know, say yes to these things. And that's really served me very well. I got a home group pretty much right away. I got a service position pretty much right away. And, you know, my experience has been that, you know, my sponsor doesn't so much tell me what to do. I just try to follow his example, and he shows me. And so in working with others, that's now what I try to do, is it's less about what I say to someone than just trying to live the program to the best of my ability in a way that I hope someone else will, because that's what works for me. That's how it works. You know, I have to go to, I'm much better off when I go to a meeting every day. And I still do that. After 90 days, I thought that I could take a break, because it was 90 and 90. And I was like, now I only need to go to 3 meetings a week, and that'll be cool. And I went 2 days without a meeting, and I was like, I'm completely crazy. You know, this is not going to work for me. So I go to a meeting every day. You know, I have to be of service within Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have a service position in my home group and, you know, at the district level. And it's great. It gives me, it opens up all these opportunities for me to learn things and to stay sober, which is a really important point. And to meet all other kinds of people who I wouldn't necessarily meet just in the, you know, normal meetings that I go to. You know, I work with others. I have sponsees, because when we got through the steps, my sponsor told me, okay, now it's time for you to start sponsoring people. And I said, I can't do that. You know, I don't have enough time. He said, whatever, this is ridiculous. He said, just raise your hand. And I can remember exactly when we had this conversation. He said, just, you know, just raise your hand when they say, is anyone willing to sponsor discuss sponsorship, and then maybe you can just discuss sponsorship. You don't have to actually be a sponsor, which is another way of tricking me into it. First two guys I sponsored went right back out within weeks or days. You know, maybe I'd heard from them once or twice, you know, right away, which was great for me, because it taught me that I don't get people sober. You know, my sponsor repeats that to me all the time. You don't get people sober, you don't get people drunk. So I don't get people sober. I now am very fortunate to be working with a group of guys who have been able to, not through me, but through the program and their higher powers, you know, stay sober for a little bit of time. And that's really cool. And they have saved my butt on a number of occasions. You know, when I'm too stubborn to make a phone call, but I'm up in my head, and somebody calls me, you know, and I'm not too stubborn not to answer the phone. That absolutely saves me, just every time. And I try to remember that when I feel like I shouldn't bother someone else in the program, is that they're probably, at that moment, too stubborn to make a phone call and really need someone to call. And so it actually helps other people for me to call them. I'm terrible at calling people. I continue to be terrible at calling people, but it's a good thing for me to remember. And the last thing I just want to say is that it was not until I was probably about a year, year and a half sober that a relationship with a higher power became a constant part of my life. That it wasn't, it was no longer the group, which is where it started. I never really balked at the God stuff. I just went, eh, it's language, whatever. It's just the language of the book. I understand it was written a long time ago. I don't care. I'm too desperate, so I don't want to fix it. Just whatever. Whatever you guys do, you seem to be working to keep you sober, so I'll do it. Show it to me. But I didn't pray much. You know, I didn't have a... the relationship with a higher power came about through working the 12 steps. I didn't have it when I got there. When I got to step 1, I did not have a relationship with a higher power. When I got to step 12, I did. And it's become much, much more important sort of on a daily basis. And it was really in the second year of sobriety that that became much more of a focus of my life. And it's made all the difference in the world. The last 6-8 months I've been very stressful. I've been looking for a job. I'm moving. There's a lot of uncertainty. And I was just thinking today about a number of my colleagues who are going through the same stuff and how I wish they could have a relationship with a higher power. They're not alcoholics. That doesn't mean they can't have a relationship with a higher power. They just happen not to. Because I don't know what I would do with all this stress and fear if I didn't have faith that there's a plan, even if I don't know what it is. And that's just been the saving grace in my life, is that, okay, I'm freaking out. I'm completely, you know, at wit's end about whatever situation it is. Fear of financial insecurity has completely, like, gone through the roof. But I know that things are going to be okay if I just put one foot in front of the other and do my job, and just, which is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, and just let the other stuff work out, you know. And my sponsor said to me at one point, when I was worried about career and job and financial stuff, and we were talking about it, and he said, do you trust that God is going to put you where you're supposed to be, or your higher power is going to put you where you're supposed to be of maximum service to others? I said, yeah, I trust that. And then he said something like, you know, that might not be where you want to be. You know, is that going to be okay? I'm like, no, it's not going to be okay. But this is the way it goes. You know, that my plans might not work out. That doesn't mean that everything's fallen apart. That doesn't mean there's no order to the universe because my plans didn't work out. My plans might not be my higher power's plan for me. And I just might need to learn that it's not all about me and what I want and what can I get out of a situation. Because that's what it was like when I was drinking. It was, what can I take from you, everyone around you, you know, anyone I encounter, any situation I encounter. And today I can still go back to that. You know, fear will drive me back to that way of thinking, and what gets me out of it is a relationship with a higher power, because the fear inventory, which I didn't really get until I did it the second time, in the fourth step, you know, where it says that, you know, we have fear because self-reliance failed us. That no matter how hard I work at making more money and paying down my credit card, it will not relieve me of my fear of financial insecurity. And I'll just get more afraid and more freaked out because I can't actually fix it. No matter how hard I tried to stay sober on my own, I couldn't do it, and the fear just sort of amplifies. The only thing I can do with the fear is give it to God, which is incredibly frustrating and hard and not a quick fix, but is the only thing that works. And so I'm grateful today that that I have a program that is a solution to all my problems, the biggest one being that I don't have to drink today. And that continues to just strike me as absolutely miraculous. So I'm really glad that you guys asked me to come today. This was a lot of fun. Thanks.